There have been about 7 earthquakes in the United States in the last day. Interesting, huh? Not all big. They're all pretty small, but they've been out there. 2s to about 3s, something like that. We're going to come back and take calls with Dr. Lucy Jones in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Lucy Jones with us, and your phone calls as we talk about earthquakes and tsunamis and all these things. Have you put tornadoes into any of these categories, Lucy?
I didn't include them in any of the stories of my book because I was trying to look at the type of disasters that are so large that they really imperil communities. And at least so far, tornadoes haven't made it up to that level.
But they are bad.
They are bad, and it's, you know, the thing is, it's a disaster if it destroys your house. It's the catastrophe when everybody's houses is gone and you now can't really get your society functioning again. And it does, but for you individually, what happens in a tornado can be worse than anything in any of these other events.
You talk about the most devastating event in California history was not what we would all think an earthquake. It was floods.
It was actually flood, and it was truly extremely devastating. The killed 1% of the population.
Oh my God!
It destroyed one third of the taxable land, bankrupted the state, and wiped out the whole ranching industry. Forced us to change to farming because over 200,000 head of cattle were drowned in the event. So it is more damaging than any earthquake we've had. But, you know, who's scared of the rain? We have an emotional reaction to earthquakes that make them seem much more frightening than the actual risk would actually predict.
Lucy, what do you think about fracking and causing earthquakes?
Oh, that's absolutely true. The fracking itself is not usually the cause of earthquakes, but often doing fracking generates a lot of wastewater. And then they dispose of the wastewater by pumping it below the level of the groundwater. And it's just basically a scientific fact that if you greatly increase the water pressure in the ground, you're going to make earthquakes more likely. So, and you know, Oklahoma's been having more earthquakes than California recently.
Well, they have. They haven't had the big one, but who knows, right?
Well, you know, 5.8 in Oklahoma, where there's nothing.
That's pretty good size,
I guess.
All right, back to the calls now we go. Gordon in Lakeland, Florida. Hi, Gordon.
Mr. Norrie, Dr. Jones, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I was a student at Florida State University in the late 90s and graduated in 2000 and got a bachelor with honors in biology and chemical science and electronics degree as well in another college. So I asked my geology professor, I told him that certain religions predict in the end times that there will be a great increase in earthquake frequency. Now, he disagreed with me, but now that we're about 20 years past that, I'd like to find out two things. First, is there really an increase in either frequency or magnitude of earthquakes? And secondly, is it something that the guy that predicted this could have predicted, knowing human nature, would drill into the ground and tamper with nature? That's my theory, is that the guy that predicted, I'm not going to mention the religion because this is not a religious topic, but the guy that predicted this probably saw human nature as drilling into the ground, tampering with nature, and he could have figured this out without God telling him, but I think that God told him. And so are earthquakes really increasing, and are they increasing because of us tampering with drilling into the ground?
Oh, overall, around the world, we don't see any increase in the rate of earthquakes. There's a random variability, but that hasn't shifted. In the areas where a lot of pumping is going on, we are seeing an increase. So in Oklahoma, Texas, Ohio, Colorado, we are seeing, without question, earthquakes that are being caused by the pumping. They are not very big. The largest earthquake we have seen so far caused by pumping is a magnitude 5.8, which is, you know, one ten-thousandth the size of the largest earthquakes that we record.
So I am a believer in abiotic oil. I think this planet, when it was formed, had this in the system. It was formed. I don't think it's just plants and dead dinosaurs. But the fact that we're extracting it from the planet, that's got to have some kind of effect too, doesn't it?
The thing is that the oil that we are getting at is all in the top kilometer or two of the ground, and that's not a depth that you get earthquakes out of. So the earthquakes have to have greater stresses and therefore are deeper in the earth. So we do see subsidence. I don't know if you know that Long Beach at one point had dropped down by about 10 feet because of all of the oil pulled out. This was back in the 30s, and the state passed a law requiring them to replace the oil they remove with water, and they were able to stop the subsidence by doing that.
Do you see a problem one day with the core of the planet? Could something happen to it?
What's your definition of one day? I can't imagine anything that human beings could do that could really get in there and affect it. In the very long run, like in billions of years, the radioactive decay will have run its course and it will cool off. But that's literally billions with a B years away.
Okay, let's go back to the calls. First-time caller Brad in Las Vegas. Hey, Brad, go ahead.
Well, George, I want to tell you thank you for your great transition from Art Bell. I'd like to acknowledge, and Lord bless his soul.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for your good work and the good tribute you did for him. It was just, it'll go down in history as some of the best tributes. I also like to acknowledge Jim Berkland, who, bless his soul, was ridiculed by, this researcher's department, and he predicted earthquakes. And I don't think this audience likes your comment, despite your background, that you go on statistics, because the Indonesian disaster. You tell me what kind of more data you need than every animal running to higher ground. And it's unfortunate that, I mean, I don't see any innovation coming out in this country. And the people that are trying to come up with theories are being ridiculed like Berkman was 30 years ago. There are satellite thermal infrared imaging techniques. That's a statistic. There is a extremely low frequency, ELF frequency, that researchers are correlating. And here's an interesting thing. In Japan, they detected strange electromagnetic signals 2 months before that major earthquake hit. And those signals were supported by what's claimed to be controversial work by Greek researchers. And so I don't see innovation. It's, you know, the P wave and S wave, that's old, okay? Can you imagine if our cell phones operated like this? So I think we need to start embracing people and stop ridiculing them. Just like your comment, you dismissed statistics. Now, if you actually went to Indonesia and interviewed people, why are the animals running away before that tsunami hit? What more do you want?
Great part about this program, Lucy, is everybody gets a chance to ask a question.
It's not surprising when animals run away before the tsunami, because that is after the earthquake, and the earthquake is indeed very frightening to them.
Well, see, the elephants head for high hills, didn't they?
There is a story of that. Whether or not more elephants went to high ground then than they do at other times, there isn't enough information to tell. And, it's...
Are you open to the possibility that maybe they have a sensor?
Yeah, but I would... it would be nice to have some evidence that it's there. And that's, as I said, there's one really clear thing that animals do, which is they perceive the beginning of the earthquake before the more... of us sensitive human beings.
They probably feel something.
Well, yeah, the beginning of the earthquake is a type of sound wave, and their senses, you know, their sound ability to hear goes to a lower register than we do. So it's quite clear that they will perceive the beginning, but that's on the order of seconds. It's the same principle that's being used to develop the earthquake early warning system now.
If somebody were able to record the tectonic plates down at the base of an earthquake, would it be loud?
Quite. The beginning of, I mean, an earthquake is, some of the waves produced in earthquakes are indeed sound waves. They're just usually at frequencies below our hearing range.
Margie in Michigan, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Marge.
Good morning. How are you doing, George?
Great. Thank you.
I'm doing well as well. And thank you, Doctor, for all your information. I have a question. This wasn't touched on yet this evening in your show, but I've heard reports about large cracks opening in the ground in Africa. Do you have any information on that, and has there been anything subsequently to that?
Yeah, I've read about this. I've heard it from colleagues. There have been a series of cracks opening up, and it's an area where on, you know, tectonic time frames over thousands of years, it is stretching apart. What appears to be happening with these sudden cracks forming is, we call them erosional features, but it's tied to water desiccation as the water's removed and things were gradually stretching out anyway. The sudden cracks, though, are drying out rather than actual tectonic motions. As I said, you can't get earthquakes at the very top of the earth. It needs to be happening farther down where there's enough friction to get things moving. I mean, imagine if you snapped your fingers. When you snap your fingers, you have them in frictional contact, and then because you push hard enough, you overcome the friction. If they weren't pushed together, you can't make a sound. And so the waves in an earthquake are like the sound that you make with your fingers. And if it was opening up, then there's no sound to be created. So we don't get earthquakes up at the top where things do open up.
Is there ever a possibility, Doctor, that the planet could crack, almost split in two because of some seismic event?
We really can't see how this would happen because the weight of all that rock really does push the rocks together. And we, you know, as I said, if it opens up, it wouldn't be an earthquake. So we never see an earthquake with the ground opening up. It's always being pushed together and sliding past each other.
Okay, back to the other calls we go. Art is in Port Arthur, Texas, on the wildcard line. Arthur, go ahead.
Good morning, George and Dr. Jones. What a consummate pleasure and honor to have someone who is so well-informed about this subject. I have two questions, and I could think of many more, but let me try to focus on these two. One is, are there any particular instances where earthquakes occurring have then triggered events that caused flooding inland that has been catastrophic? And then the final question is, live here on the Gulf of Mexico, and is this the site where the 60-inch rains happened as a result of Hurricane Harvey? You've not mentioned much to do with tropical systems, but since we're on the Gulf, are there any risk of tsunamis near the Gulf of Mexico and or any fault zones in the general area that are a concern?
Okay, let's first talk about earthquakes that have caused flooding away from the ocean. One common effect of very large earthquakes is to cause landslides, and depending on where the dirt ends up, you can have it hit water. There was an earthquake in 1957 in Montana that caused landslides that then blocked a river and caused a lake to form behind the dam, and then after a couple of weeks, the water broke through and created a flood. We worry quite a bit about the possibility of breaking dams in an earthquake that could lead to triggered floods. So it's definitely a real concern. In the Gulf of Mexico, there, like up around Texas, no, there aren't any significant faults, but the Caribbean is characterized by faults, and there's a closure of a plate, and you have subduction zones there. So tsunamis have been generated, especially in the eastern Caribbean, out around, I'm going to forget the name of the islands, but the, well, Haiti, obviously, and the Dominican Republic, and as you go farther east from there. And so
La Palma,
they don't happen
I
guess. Very often, but yes, they can trigger tsunamis. Probably by the time it gets to Florida, it'll be dissipated, but it's going to depend exactly which part of the fault goes.
And the big one in the Canary Islands is La Palma?
I think so. It's not a place where my geography is really clear because it's not a place that I've personally worked.
Tom in the Bronx in New York. Go ahead, Thomas.
I'd like to say that a major portion of this continent, I always wonder if the major volcano in Yellowstone Park, perhaps it's the anchor for the major portion of the continent, and it exploded, and it's responsible for creating the like close to the 48 states that we live in, where we are. Is that possible? That's one question. Then the next question is, if you took all of this loose plastic that's floating in the Pacific, and you're able to put it into the volcano in that hot volcano to melt it down, would it be come out safe and not be polluting or dangerous to the environment?
Well, depends on how much plastic is there, I guess.
Well, it's like the area that's as big as Texas is floating around.
Yeah, that would create an issue, I think. Go ahead,
yeah,
Lisa.
Yeah, there's when you melt the plastic, it creates unfortunate compounds that are not good for human health. In terms of creating the whole lower 48 with the what happens out of Yellowstone, you know, we can measure the age of rocks across the states, and especially in the eastern U.S., there's rocks that are billions of years old, so long before any of the Yellowstone caldera was there. The last time it erupted, it created an ash fall, so there's a layer of rock, of ash, volcanic ash, that was distributed over about a third of the country.
All right, we've got about a minute left. Would you tell people, Lucy, how people can get your book? Then we're going to take a break and come back with final calls.
Okay, well, the Big Ones was just published by Doubleday last week, and it's available at all the major bookstores and online sellers as well. So both hardback and e-books and audiobook is available.
Is this your first book?
It is my first book. I worked for the government for 33 years, and if I had written a book while I worked for them, it would have belonged to them, and I waited till I got the royalties.
Super. Did you ever meet Jim Berklin?
Yes, I did. He was a
nice guy.
He was a very nice guy, and he had his own statistics, and you know, he tried to show the correlations, and it was, you know, we actually kept a record. One of the things we did at the USGS is anybody could call us with predicting earthquakes, and we kept a record of the predictions
just to see
and compared the ones that we actually got before the earthquake happened. And one of the things Jim tended to call after the earthquake and said, I really did predict it.
Ah, okay. We're coming back for more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our final segment with Dr. Lucy Jones and your calls. Her book is called The Big Ones. Gosh, I sure hope we don't get the big one, Lucy.
Yeah. And, you know, chances are we won't, because they don't, by definition, if they happened often in every lifetime, we would be better prepared for them.
And what is the big one to you in terms of Richter scale?
It's not a Richter scale number, because we've gone through magnitude 9s without them being that bad because they aren't near people.
Okay, that's a good point.
It's an earthquake that's bad enough to disrupt the society, functioning of society.
If a 9 hit New York City, would it be a disaster?
Oh, yes. If it was actually underneath the city, but it's also, I think, theoretically impossible the fault needed for a 9 is very, very large. If you had a 7 that ran through New York City, it would be catastrophic, but that's also highly unlikely.
How do we know where the fault lines are?
Okay, I mean, a fault is a place where rocks of different ages and styles abut each other because they've been pushed together over time. And that's what the whole field of, much of field geology does, is recognize the types of rocks and then see how they come together. And we've been able to create this picture of the faults that makes physical sense, and we can see how they relate with each other. And so here in California, we just have a much higher density of faults than out on the East Coast, and we have a much higher rate of earthquakes. But some level of earthquake is possible everywhere because some faults are buried, or we put in a lot of houses before we went to look for the features so that we've obliterated them before we could see them.
Okay, let's go to Vic, truck driving near the Oregon-California edge. Let's go to you, Vic. Welcome to the show. Hi, Vic.
Well, thank you. Hello. Doctor, two quick questions. The first one is, have you studied rogue waves, where they come from, how they originate, and do we have satellites now to detect them? And my second question would be, have you studied the Sierra National Forest, where it's been pretty active here lately? And what's your thoughts about that?
The first question, I didn't hear the word clearly. Rogue waves?
Yes. A rogue wave, which is a wave in the ocean that is literally taller than a ship, that starts from nowhere, from what I can understand about them. And as far as I know, maritime operations have no way of detecting them.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Since my work, you know, was always with the solid Earth, I've never looked much at wave propagation in the ocean. And I gather that, you know, they can see the big patterns, and sometimes there's just things that form up out of chaotic conditions that they don't know how to do it. I have studied the earthquakes up through the Sierras, and we can see there's, you know, California is an interesting place. We talk about the San Andreas, and that's the main boundary, and the biggest earthquakes happened there. But there's a whole web of faults that go out around it. It's sort of like if you were, you know, you had two pieces of glass and you were pushing them past each other. Yeah, most of them happen on the border between it, but you'd break up the pieces along the edges and those get carried along. And the Sierra Nevada is one of the places where we sort of see these broken up pieces. It has fewer earthquakes than the San Andreas, but there's still plenty of them there. And, of course, when you get up to where you're driving right now, you're actually getting up into a volcanic region from Mount Shasta north. You actually have active volcanoes all the way through that area. So, and we see a small level of earthquakes around all of those. And the USGS is trying to monitor those because if we start seeing more than that low level, it might be a sign that the volcano is becoming active.
Okay, next up, Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
All right.
Hi. I wanted to ask Lucy Jones, Manhattan is built on bedrock, which is, I understand, one of the hardest foundations for building on. If an earthquake were to strike, and I did survive a 5.3 earthquake a few years ago here in New York City. If an earthquake were to strike Manhattan Island, would the fact that it's built on bedrock perhaps minimize the damage that, let's say, a 6 on the Richter scale would do?
Well, yes. I mean, a couple of questions in there. One is that whatever the waves are coming in, if they come into loose soils, they slow down in those loose soils, and then to carry the same amount of energy, they have to get bigger. So we always see amplification in loose soils, and that means the bedrock is having a lower level of shaking. So at a place where you're on hard rock, it's always better than being in the soil. In terms of what a particular magnitude does, it really depends on where it is. I mean, the 5.8 that was definitely felt in New York City was actually located down in Virginia. So the level of shaking in New York was much smaller. If you produce the same size earthquake on a fault in New York City, say the Ramapo Fault that runs up through the northern part of Manhattan, then you would have a very high level of damage. And you know, there is a fault. We can map it. You were asking before about how we recognize the faults. But it's not at all clear that it's moved any time recently. And faults do stop having motion as the motion changes with deep within the earth. And so recognizing whether a fault is active is just as important as recognizing that it's there and in existence.
Lucy, what do you do next? What's on your plate?
Finish the book tour that I'm doing at this moment, but I've started a nonprofit center for science and society, because a lot of these things that we know about the disasters could be used to build safer cities. You know, recognizing the role of, you know, the damage to water pipes. That's a thing that you can say, okay, it's going to save us this much money if we deal with them, and it'll help people be able to make the decisions of which of these things are worthwhile. But it only works if you understand the information. And, you know, as we know, there's a lot of trouble communicating between the scientific and the policy-making committees or communities. So I'm focusing on how to help policymakers understand the science that we have so they can make better decisions, and also on helping scientists become better communicators, because we tend to speak in pretty different ways than the rest of the community, and it's led to a lot of misunderstandings, and I'm hoping to try and help with that.
Diane's with us in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hi, Diane.
Hi there, George. Hi. Lucy, is that it?
Lucy, yeah. It is.
Hi. I have a couple of questions and a comment. Are you familiar? Well, we had a Nisqually earthquake here a few years back, and I was about within a mile of it as the crow flies. So I got some significant shaking at my place. It's a 3.8, I believe. My question is, what about the Ring of Fire? Is that going to affect the Northwest very much?
Okay, so the Ring of Fire is an old term, just says there's a lot of earthquakes around the Pacific. Now that we understand plate tectonics, we can see where different plates are coming together and explain why the Ring of Fire is there. And yes, the Pacific Northwest is sitting on a subduction zone, so one of the places where two plates come together. And geologists and been able to put things together and compare with records in Japan and show that there was an earthquake in the Pacific Northwest in 1700 that was big enough to create a tsunami that did damage in Japan. So and the fact that you've got your volcanoes here as well are also part of that same system. So eventually the Pacific Northwest will be having much bigger earthquakes than the Nisqually earthquake, but they don't happen very often. They happen on average about once every 500 years.
Tell me about your BA in Chinese language. How did that happen?
Well, I was actually, to show I'm a geek, I was doing a double major in physics and Chinese. And my senior year, I took my first geology class and got completely hooked and realized I wanted to do seismology instead of physics. And by taking the Chinese degree, I got out of taking advanced electromagnetics.
Interesting take. Are you still consulted by the USGS?
There's quite strict ethics rules with the governments, and you're not allowed to be a contractor for 2 years after you leave the government. So no official work that way. But I continue to give some advice to the programs that we're keeping on going, and especially helping people face, probably more personnel and management advice than direct scientific advice at this point.
Thomas in La Jolla, California now. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. You know, Lucy, the Cascadian Fault in Oregon
Is there a possibility that that could be triggered in the next 20, even 50 years?
Oh, it's absolutely possible. On the long-term average, you know, it's about 500 years for the really biggest earthquakes. There may be some smaller ones on more often, but that's only on the average. And every place we've gone and looked, we see it extremely variable. So there's absolutely the possibility, but not the probability. It's possible, but not 50% chance that we would be having the earthquake in the next 20 years.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right, let's take a couple more calls as the clock ticks. Paul, truck driving in Georgia, is with us now. Go ahead, Paul.
Good morning.
Morning.
Doctor, I read recently that the pole, some geologists believe that the poles are going to shift. And I'm wondering if there's any correlation between pole shift and major geological occurrences. And if so, the pole does shift. Is there a chance it could cause precipitate earthquakes and volcanic activity? Thank you. I'll take my answer off here.
I think it's a time scale issue. When we can see the shifting, when we talk about shifting poles, it's really shifting of the magnetic north, and that will flip. And we're not completely sure how fast that happens, but it's probably on the order of a century or two. So we don't think it's going to be leading to particular earthquakes. We can't see any evidence in the geology that that's happened in the past, but we probably won't know completely until we experience the event.
Let's go to Salt Lake City, Utah. Jay's with us. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking the call, George.
Sure.
Look, I'm a survivor of the tsunami in 2004 in Thailand. I was 16 at the time, and my younger sister, Kali, woke me up and saved my life and lost her own. I do live in Salt Lake City, and after that catastrophic event, I sort of have this great awareness of my surroundings, and I am often worried about the Wasatch Fault Line that lives a mile away from me, you know, and runs along Salt Lake City and the main portions of Utah. Is there anything you know about that? And I know we are expecting a, quote, big one.
Right. Yes, as I said, every community has some big one at some point in their future. The Wasatch Fault has a big earthquake on average about once every 1,400 years. So it's much less frequent than some of these other events. But it does lie underneath the basin for Salt Lake City. So we think that the shaking will be quite strong when that earthquake does happen. And I think that if you want to learn more about it, actually the universities there in Salt Lake City have a lot of information about it. But also there's a move I know in Salt Lake City to try and deal with some of the older buildings. And that gets back to the one I just need to say over and over again. I mean, a tsunami, if it comes through, there's not a lot you can do about it. But for an earthquake, you can really build buildings that don't fall down. And I know that one of the big issues in Salt Lake City is they have a lot of older brick buildings. And those are some of the very most dangerous buildings in earthquakes. And if there was one thing that Salt Lake City could do to be safer, I would say it would be to mandate that those very dangerous buildings get strengthened, which will greatly reduce the likelihood of them breaking when that earthquake happens.
Karen is in West Frankfort, Illinois. Let's squeeze you in, Karen. Go ahead.
Thank you, George, for taking my call. And Dr. Lucy, I live in West Frankfort, Illinois. It's way down in Southern Illinois. And there was a guy named Scallion said that a lot of the USA is going to go underwater. And I read that the Mississippi River is supposed to widen from to about 100 to 150 miles wide, and most of Southern Illinois and most of Illinois will be gone. And we've got the New Madrid Falls here. I've been thinking about moving away. I'm going to be in the family, this house, 100 years in two more years, but I've thought about getting out of here. What do you say about that?
Psychics have predicted that there'll be major earth changes, Lucy.
I wouldn't move on that basis. I guess the most likely way of really increasing the width of that river is actually because of climate change, increasing sea levels and encroaching up from the south. New Orleans is a place I'd worry about. Once you get up into Illinois, it seems a lot less significant that this is likely to be moving. And there is the fault that runs there through Missouri, the New Madrid seismic zone. Mm-hmm. Those are earthquakes that happen about once every 500 years. So they're not high on anybody's list right now as the most likely site of a big earthquake.
Lucy, thank you. Keep in touch with us. Love to use you as an earthquake expert if we can. For Dan Galante, Donna Walker, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burleson, George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.